On Ayin Chesam, it bays 10 lines up, it says, Tonra Bonon Hamotzi Shtar Chov. So let me just give you a little background here, because we're moving on ahead here in this parak. This whole chapter is dedicated to Meleches Hotzah, but specifically to determine what the Shear of Hotzah is. And every object is a little different. The basic underlying rule is that you need something chashiv, it has chashivas to it. And if it's something significant, it means it's worth carrying it. And therefore, if you have that minimum quantity, like for example, the Gemara discusses water. So how much of a quantity of water, or in the case of yayin, of wine. So the Gemara says, Well, for a koshal bracha, you would carry a revius yayin. In the case of water, they used to use water to mix it with a salve and put it on a wound. How much water would it take to heal a wound, and so forth and so on. So now, we're going to talk about Tana Rabbanan HaMotzi Shtar Chov Ad Shelo Parao Chayev. So if the Malve is holding on to the Shtar, and that means that he'll use the Shtar in order to collect from someone, so that's a very valuable Shtar, and it's basically like holding a check or money in your hand, and the loan has not been paid up, so therefore it's a very chashuva thing, so he's chayev for that. But what about in the case of Misha Parao? Let's say the Lova, in this case, paid up a Chov, and the law is that when the Lova pays up the Chov, he gets back the Shtar. In other words, there's a swap. The Lova says, I owe you $1,000, take this $1,000, and give me the Shtar back. And now the Lova carries the Shtar. So here's a machlokes between the Tanakama, this Brisa, and Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanakama says, Potur. And Rabbi Yehuda says, Chayev, Af Shep Misha Paro, even though he's already paid up the Chov, this is still an object of significance, it's got value, and if he's Chayev, why? Bibnei Shetzorach Lo, he needs it. What does it mean he needs it? And what is he going to do with the Shtar? I mean, he's already paid it up, and he can use it as a, hang it up in his closet. And the answer is, I believe, although the Gemara is going to go in a different direction, that the reason why he, the Lova, that paid up this Chov, once sold on to the Shtar, is that if the Malva comes back and says to him, my friend, you didn't pay me up, well, the Lova is going to produce the Shtar, and the very fact that the Lova is holding on to the Shtar, that proves, that's like a receipt, that he paid it up. But the Gemara is going to go in a different direction. So let's just see the Gemara. My Beinayu, what's the machlokas here between Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanakama, Omer Rav Yosef? The entire machlokas revolves around the following statement, the following principle. Asur Lishos Shtar Parua, are you allowed to hold on to a Shtar that's already been paid up? Rabbanan Savri Asur, you're not allowed to hold on to the Shtar. The Lova would be violating the ethical laws of Judaism if he holds on to the Shtar. He should really rip up the Shtar, throw it in the rubbish bin. Why? Because if he holds on to the Shtar, then who knows what's going to happen if, let's say, now we have to ask the following question. Well, the Rabbanan hold Asur Lashol Shtar Parua. Who is this Isur addressed to? In other words, if you're talking about the Malve, then I can understand that the Malve should not be holding on to this Shtar. Right? He's the lender, because heaven forbid he may forget at some point that this Shtar was paid up. So in event that the Lova didn't take back the Shtar and he, for whatever reason, he left it in the possession of the Malva would have to get rid of the Shtar, according to this Rabbanon, because, you know what? This is a very dangerous object to hold in your possession. I'm reminded of a Gemara in Ksubis. The Gemara says that if you have a Sefer Torah and it's puzzle, then you should take care of it immediately. You know, you shouldn't leave it around, because if you leave around the Shtar, a Sefer Torah that's puzzel, somebody might be tempted to use it, not knowing that it's puzzel. And That's called Al Tishkon Avlo Bebeisecha. It's a pasuk in Mishlei, which the Gemara applies in many cases that you shouldn't leave something in your possession that could be dangerous if you don't know and you don't remember what exactly the circumstances are. In the case of the Malva holding on to the Shtar Perua, he may forget about the fact that the Lova paid him back, and therefore, you know, he may use that shtar a second time around and illegitimately collect from the lova based on the shtar. The lova is going to say, "Well, I paid you back," and the malva is going to say, "Well, I'm holding on to the shtar. It's impossible that you paid me back." So, from the lender's position perspective, the malva, this shtar is actually worthless. Why is it worthless? Because he's not allowed to keep this shtar in his possession. You know, it's normally a shtar, like we said before, you know, it's a beautiful piece of artwork. The sofer made a beautiful shtar, and maybe you should have it framed and put it up, you know, like it's a handwritten ksuba, you know. But the answer is no. In the case of the malva, he's not allowed to hold on to the shtar. So we thought that the machlokes in this brisa was about a shtar parua in the hands of the lova. Everybody would agree that you chayev an otzah if, as far as the lova is concerned, the borrower, because he needs the shtar in order to prove down the line that he has already repaid, you know, he paid the shtar, he paid the chol. He needs it as a receipt. So that couldn't be the subject of this machlokes. Everybody would agree that the lova is chayav in that case. But maybe the shtar is now in the hands of the possession of the malva, and the malva, according to the Tanakhama, is not allowed to hold on to the shtar. He's got to get rid of it. He's got to destroy it. And therefore, it's worthless. It's not worth it even to hang up on the wall. As far as the lova is concerned, well, you know, he may want to use it, as we said, as a receipt. And if he doesn't want to use it as a receipt, let's say he trusts the malva would never come back to him. He doesn't have to get rid of it. It's not dangerous. I mean, it's actually parua, so he can use it as a beautiful piece of artwork and frame it and work and put it on his wall. So now we're stuck with Rabbi Yehuda. Because Rabbi Yehuda, if we read this correctly, he's saying that even though the shtar was paid up, and the malve, the lender, is holding on to this shtar, it still has chashivas to him. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Sover, muto lishos shtar parua. In other words, the malve is allowed to hold on to this shtar, even though it was already paid up. Now the question is, why do we allow him, according to Rabbi Yehuda, to retain such a dangerous document? I don't know. I'm tempted to think that according to Rabbi Yehuda, maybe the malve will be allowed to use the shtar a second time around. Let's say the lova pays up a loan, and then, with the passage of time, the lova realizes that he needs the money again, the second time around. He has to invest it, or he took a loss, and he needs to buy food for his family. So the malva is going to save himself the hassle, and even the money, because to write up a shtar, you have to pay a sofer for that. Right. And he's going to use the same shtar a second time. But you see, this we're getting into a whole sugya, which is called Nimchal Shibudo, which means that a shtar is only valid for one particular halva. You can't use it a second time. Uh-huh. So we have to figure out here what Rabbi Yehuda is saying. Okay, right now, we're assuming that the shtar was in the hands of the malva, and he carried it out in Rishus HaRavim, let's say Dalet Amos, and according to Tanakhama, he's potter because he wasn't even, this shtar is worthless, not worth the paper it's written on. According to Rabbi Yehuda, he's allowed to retain the shtar, and therefore it's got chashivas to him. Now the Gemara says, Abai Omar, perhaps this is a different approach. The Kuli Alma also lishol shtar peru. Even Rabbi Yehuda would agree that the malva is not allowed to hold onto the shtar. But why does Rabbi Yehuda say Yechayef Otzah on the shtar? Hacha, this case that's discussed in our Brice and Torah Rabbanon is b'mode b'shtar sheksovo shetzorch l'kaimo kamiflugi. They're arguing about the following issue. Normally, when a malve comes with a shtar to a love, the love has a right to deny the chov, not by saying I paid you back, but he could say I never borrowed the money. This whole entity called a document is a counterfeit. And there are no two witnesses that are signed on this document. So the malva says to the lover, what do you mean? I got two signatures. He says, no. These are not authentic signatures. This is a plagiary. So there's a whole process by which the malva has to prove that his shtar is authentic. That's called Kiyum Shtaros. You familiar with that? Kiyum Shtaros. Okay. He's gotta bring in two witnesses that recognize the signature.
Okay.
Where I come from, they used to call it John Hancock, because he was one who signed on the Declaration of Independence. Anyway, right. So you have to verify the signatures. But there's another case where the Lova says to the Malva, I paid you back already. Mm-hmm. In that case, he is implicitly validating the shtar. He didn't say, well, this shtar is a forgery. He says, well, I paid you back. So that's called mode b'shtar sheksavo. In other words, he's admitting, although not explicitly, but implicitly, that this shtar was a valid shtar. The only thing is, although I did borrow, and these eidim had signed on the shtar of valid signatures, but I paid you back.
Right.
So Tanakama Sovar, according to Tanakam, who says you're potter on Shabbos, that's because modu b'shtar sheksavo tzorach l'kaimo, which means that despite the fact that the lova admits that the shtar is a valid shtar, nevertheless, the malva still has to verify the shtar. He's got to authenticate the signatures. And if he cannot do so, then the shtar is meaningless. And we're going to believe the lova when he says parati, when he says I paid up this chov. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, on the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda Shita is modu b'shtar sheksavo, ein tzorach l'kaimo. Once the lova admits, by implication, that this shtar is a valid shtar, and he's verifying the shtar because he's only claiming that he paid him back, but he's admitting that the shtar has a valid status. In such a case, then the shtar is a validated shtar. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda holds that in such a case where the lova admits that the shtar is valid, he's just saying, I paid you up. The shtar is a very valuable tool because the lova is not going to be believed against the shtar. In other words, once he himself admits that the shtar is valid, then we're going to always ask him the question, well, if you really, truthfully, you paid back the chov, why didn't you take back the shtar? Umay Adshalo Pro. Umisha Pro, now we have to go back to the language of the Brisa. The Brisa says that if you find a shtar, if you carry a shtar chov, then it depends. If it's Adshalo Pro, then everybody agrees that you're chayev. But Misha Pro, if he paid it up, he's potter, according to Tanakama. Well, that doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, Misha Pro? We're not talking about a case of Misha Pro. He's claiming that he paid up, but we don't know that he paid up. In fact, Rabbi Yehuda holds that we don't even believe him that he paid up. So what's this language, Misha Pro? And here we have to turn to Daf Ayin Testament Aleph. Ad sheyomer lo ve'parati ve'lo parati. What the Mishnah, what the Brisa means to say is that there's a difference between the following two cases. In the first case, where the lova says lo parati, so the Tanakhama holds that even though he's implying that the shtar if he says parati, right? If he says parati, so then he's implying that the shtar is a valid. If he says lo parati, there's no question that the shtar is a valid shtar, and therefore he's chayef. Why? Because we're not going to believe the lova to say just 1 second. If he said, if the lover, admits lo parati, he confesses that he hasn't paid it up, so he has to pay by virtue of his own confession. I don't need the shtar in this case. I need the shtar in the case where he says parati, that I paid up already. If he says lo parati, then odas bal din kamei eidim dom, he admits that he didn't pay up. So he's got to pay by virtue of his own admission. But if he says parati, then he's going to have to pay by virtue of the fact that the malva is holding on to a shtar. Right. And even though, just 1 second, let's just think this out. We're holding now that moda b'shtar shek sovo is moda b'shtar shek sovo. Just 1 second, let me just make the calculation. Is Tzorech L'Kaimo, or now we're holding Tzorech L'Kaimo, that even though, despite the Hodah of the Lover, the Malva still has to be Mekayim the Shtar, and the Malva has no way of being Mekayim the Shtar, he cannot authenticate its signatures. Is that be the case, then the Tanakhama holds that the Shtar is worthless because the Shtar She'eino Mekuyam. So let me just review. The Tanakhama holds that even though the Lover admits that the shtar is a valid shtar, but he says parati, and at this point, if he says parati, is modem shtar shiksovo tsorech lekaimo, it means that he doesn't have to pay until such time as the malva is able to be mekayim shtar, and if the malva fails and he's unable to authenticate the shtar, then the shtar is worthless, and the Lover is potter, he doesn't have to pay. Rabbi Yehuda, on the other hand, holds that once the Lover admits that the shtar is a valid shtar, even though he claims parati, nevertheless, based on this shtar, we're going to force the Lover to pay up. And therefore, the shtar is a very significant shtar, and it's worth a lot.
The battle moves, the argument moves to depending on where they agree and where they disagree.
Correct. And there are two ways of learning what they're disagreeing about. One way is learning is where the Malva is allowed to keep the shtar once it was paid up. And the Tanakhama says, no, he's got to chuck it into the rubbish because Osula Hashos shtar parua biyado. It's a very dangerous pitfall, so to speak, a possible michshol if he leaves the shtar in his possession. He may come and claim a second time. And Rabbi Yehuda never said so. Rabbi Yehuda says he's not going to use the shtar a second time. And we're now off to be Choshesh, and therefore he's allowed to keep the shtar. And let him keep the shtar as a piece of artwork.
Yeah.
And if that be the case, then it's worth something. And Rabbi Yehuda says, Yechai Fotza. The second explanation, which was Abaye, is they're arguing about a shtar that's not Mekuyam, it doesn't have any authentication on it. That means we can't find anyone to verify these signatures, and we assume that it might be a false shtar, it's a forgery. What we call a counterfeit. Yeah. But the problem is, wait a minute. What do you mean it's a counterfeit? The Lover doesn't claim it's a counterfeit. The Lover is saying, I paid you up the chol. This is a valid shtar, but I paid you up.
Right.
So now we have a machlokes. Correct. Now we got the machlokes in the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanakhama says that despite the fact that the Lover admits that the shtar is valid, the shtar is not valid. Why? Because modem shtar shiksovo tsarach lekaima. And Rabbi Yehuda holds no. Once we pulled out the admission from the Lover that the shtar is a valid shtar, it's a shtar. And even when the Lover claims parati, he's not gonna be believed. Hence the shtar is valuable, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda says yichai fotsa. Rava Omar de kuli alma. Everybody agrees that modem shtar shiksovo tsarach lekaima. Which means that now we have a problem with Rabbi Yehuda. Why? Because if we're saying that the shtar, if it's not authenticated and there was no kiyum, it's a worthless shtar, that's called tsarach lekaimo. So why you chayfa hutzah in a case where the love is believed to say parati and the Malva doesn't have a what we call a koch hashtar, he has no power insofar as he's holding on to the shtar, because it's ainu mekuya. There's no kiyum on the shtar, even though, again, the Lova admits that the shtar is a valid shtar. but we need independent authentication.
Right.
So now what is Rabbi Yehuda saying? V'hacha, says Rabbi, b'kosvin shovar ka miflegi. Tanakama sovar kosvin shovar. Rabbi Yehuda sovar ain kosvin shovar.
The
shovar is a receipt. So now the machlokus is, does the love have a right to demand a separate shtar from the malva, which is called a shtar shovar, it's a receipt, or does he not have the right? And if he doesn't have the right to demand a receipt, then how does he prove that he paid up? He needs some sort of proof of payment, and the answer is the shtar milva itself that he gets back from the malva is going to be proof positive that he paid back the shtar, he paid back the chov. So let's just go through. Tanakama sovar kosvin shtar, kosvin shovar. And Tanakama says that the love, the borrower, has rights to demand a receipt, and he'll receive a receipt. If he doesn't have a receipt, he's not believed. And if he's not believed, then the shtar itself, the original shtar, is worthless. Because even if the malva has the shtar, but we're holding kosvin shovar, and kosvin shovar means that the love, once he pays up the chov, then he has a shovar. I'm not sure if he's holding. Let me just see a footnote here. Is he actually holding on to a shovar? I don't know. The borrower, the love consented to repay the loan because the malva assured him the lender still has. Let me just figure this out. I'm trying to work this through, but I'm just going to summarize what it means. Tanakama sovar kosvin shovar. Why is the shtar milve so insignificant? And the answer is because if the lova says to the malva, "Listen, buddy, I'm not going to pay you back. I want the shtar back." Because if I leave the shtar in your hands, Mr. Malva, you'll use it against me in the future. And the Malva can't find the shtar now. So the Malva is really in deep trouble. His ankles are mud deep. Why? Because he's not going to get his money back because he misplaced the shtar.
Right.
And the answer is, no problem. All he has to do is write out a shovar. He can forget about the old shtar, let it go to, you know, up to the heavens, and he's going to take out a piece of paper and write a shovar. I hereby testify that so-and-so, Mr. Lover, paid me back. So the Malva is not in dire straits because he can extract his money from the Lover by giving the Lover a shovar, and the Lover is going to be perfectly comfortable with paying back the Malva. He won't have any hesitations or any inhibitions because he knows he's going to get a shovar. So therefore the shtar itself, the original shtar milva, is worthless. Well, what significance does it have? Oh, Rabbi Yehuda Sovar ein kosvin shovar. In other words, the malva is not allowed to write a shovar, which I'm not sure why, but rather he's got to produce the original document. So the lova says to the malva, no way, no how. I am not going to pay you back until you give me the shtar. Don't talk to me about a shovar, about a receipt. So it means that the malva needs this shtar in order to extract payment from the lova, because the lova has a right to say, until you give me this shtar, I'm not going to pay you back. Because ein kosvin shovar. We don't allow the lender, the malva, to write a shovar, a receipt. So now the malva is in deep trouble if he can't find the shtar. The shtar is very valuable to him because the lova has the right to refuse payment until such time as he gets the shtar. Ravashi Omar, Ravashi has a fourth interpretation. The machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanakama in the Braisa is about a shtar that was carried by the Lova. This was our original understanding. And the Tanakama holds that the Lova has no use for the shtar. Why? Because the Lova paid up the Chov and he doesn't need the shtar. Why isn't he afraid that the Malva will produce the shtar a second time? Just one second. In other words, according to Ravashi, we're not afraid that the Malva is going to produce the shtar against the Lova a second time around. We're not going to allow him to do so. And the Lova has paid up the Chov, and he doesn't need the shtar. He has no use for the shtar, according to Tanakama. You have to add another point over here. And that is that even the Lova is afraid to leave the shtar in existence. You know, the Lova himself is going to set a torch to this, to the shtar.
Right, he doesn't want it around.
Yeah, he doesn't want it floating around because you never know what will happen. You know, somebody will find the shtar and give it back to the Malva. Maybe the Malva will steal the shtar. I don't know what. That shtar is a very potent, dangerous document. So the Lova has to get rid of the shtar.
So what happens if I think this came up, but I wasn't really sure what the Maskana was. If it's a case where the lender he has the shtar chov, but he lost it. But the borrower agrees that he has to pay it back, and he pays it back, but there's no shtar chov at the time. And then a month later, the lender is going through his things, and he finds the shtar chov.
So unless somebody will testify to the effect that the Lova paid up, if the Lova doesn't have such testimony, then he'll have to pay a second time because the Malva is going to cheat him and illegitimately he's going to produce the shtar. And if the Lova is in a very precarious situation to pay back the Chov without getting his shtar back. So if you hold Kosvin, Shovar, no problem. We're going to allow the Malva to write a Shovar. The Lova will pay him back. They'll make a swap. Although the Lova won't get back his original shtar, he'll get back a shovar. And that shovar will be proof positive, even if the Malva will try to cheat him, or mistakenly, forgetting that he paid it back, he'll try to pull off the shtar. It doesn't matter. The Lova has a shtar that says, I paid you back. But according to Rabbi Yehuda says that the Lova has a right to hang in there, and say I'm not going to be willing to pay you back until you give me the shtar, because according to you, they ain't kosvin shovar. We don't write a shovar, and therefore the Malva is desperately in need of this shtar. It's the only way that he can legally force the Lova to pay him up.
Right.
That's according to Rava. Now we get to Ravashi. Ravashi introduces a whole other element into the equation. And that is the Lova. The Lova is holding on to the shtar. He paid back the Malva. So you'll ask me, what value does the shtar have for the Lova? What does he need it for? Mm-hmm. So the Tanakhava says, he's got to get rid of it. Or, I shouldn't say he has to get rid of it, but he's going to get rid of it. Why? Because this is a dangerous thing to leave around in the halal ha'olam, anywhere in the world. You never know which hands are going to get a hold of the shtar. Get rid of it. Right. You paid up the shtar, get rid of the shtar. Don't hold on to the shtar. Why? Because you may lose it, and guess what? The finder is going to look in the shtar, see the name of the Malva, he's going to return it to the Malva. The Malva is going to collect from the Lova a second time. Right. So the Lova, according to the Tanakhama, is not going to want to hold on to this shtar. He's going to want to make sure that this shtar is gone. Decimated.
Right.
set it aflame. What does Rabbi Yehuda hold? He says, "Mipnei shetzarach la'aroso lebalchov sheni." He has to show it to a second balchov. The Omar le chazi gavra de para ano. Wow, this is fascinating. When a person comes to borrow money, and this I can tell you because we ran a gemach, you need some sort of a credit rating. You know, somebody has to come forward and show that you have a good rating. In banks, it works the same way. You want to take out a loan from a bank, the bank is going to check your credit rating. They have a whole number system. Why?
Yeah, yeah.
They want to know what have you done in the past. That's really interesting. There's almost a counterintuitive principle here. If you've never taken a loan in the past, your credit rating is not necessarily very good. But if you've taken a loan in the past and you paid up that loan, then your credit rating jacks up. So therefore, the lover knows that if in the future he will be in need of taking a loan and they're going to ask him for credit referrals, he has a shtar parua to show that he paid up the chob. And therefore, his credit rating goes up, and according to Rav Ashi, now that shtar in the hands of the lover is very, very valuable because he can use that as credit, as to proving that he has a very good record and he pays his debts. And that's called chazi. Take a look at me. Gavra de parano. I'm a person who pays up my chob. And again, even though the Tanakhama says, well, it's dangerous to keep this shtar in your possession, you never know who might get a hold of it, and then it goes back to the hands of the malva. But no, says Rabbi Yehuda, there's a much more important consideration that kicks in, and he's going to decide this lover that he wants the shtar. You know, again, he'll put it on the lock and key, you know, he'll put it in his safe, but he's got to hold on to the shtar, says Rabbi Yehuda, because if he ever needs a loan down the line, then he wants to use the shtar as his proof. Okay, now at this point, we're going to go back to another material. As we said, there's so many different materials, and we want to find out what is the chashivus of these various materials. What would you use them for, and therefore, what would be the minimum amount, a quantity, a volume that makes it significant enough that you'd be chayev for meleches hotzah on Shabbos. And now we're going to take up the case of R with an ayin, which means hides, the hides of a skin. And here we're going to take a look at the Mishnah on Daf. Where is it? On Daf Ayin Ches Amud Beis. Okay, Daf Ayin Ches Amud Beis. So we don't have to go very far back. And the Mishnah speaks about R. And the shear of R, of hides, is enough to make an amulet. In those days, what they would do is they took a hide, and they made parchment out of it, and then they would hire a scribe to write a kamiya, an amulet. And they would put together certain psukim, and they believed if they had the secrets, which we don't have anymore, but they had the secrets of which psukim in the Torah were powerful enough to heal which diseases. It was a whole science. And every hide, you know, that was made into a parchment would have to have, in order to use it as a kamiya and write various psukim on it, so it would have to have a minimum size. And the Gemara wants to know exactly what that minimum size is. The Mishnah says, "Or kidei lasos kamiya." Fine. How much is that? Is boy minei Rava mi Rav Nachman? Rava asked his Revi Rav Nachman, "Hamotzi or bekama?" how large of a hide of a parchment does he qualifies for the minimum shear of hotzah? How large does it have to be? Amar Rav Nachman answered, Kisnan. We have our Mishnah, or Kidei Lasos Kamiya. And basically, what Rav Nachman is answering to Rava is that your question was already addressed by the Mishnah. Now, Rava knows about the Mishnah, but he was asking something else. You follow? We're going to find out exactly what was his question. Sometimes you ask a first question as an introduction to a second question. And this is a perfect example, because it couldn't be that Rava was perplexed about the minimum size of R, because the mission itself answers that question. Kidei lasos kamiya. Again, exactly how much that is, I don't know. You know what I mean? You might write an amulet with 5 psukim, and somebody else writes it with 1 psukim. So how large of a parchment do you need? But somehow the Gemara, at this point at least, understood the size of the size of the parchment. So if we go back to the Mishnah one more time without losing the place again, the Mishnah says, Kidei lasos kamiya. What was the minimum, a significant amount, lasos kamiya, to write psukim that would cure diseases? These parchments were often wrapped in pieces of partially tanned hide. The Mishnah teaches that the minimum significant amount of such a hide is enough to wrap an amulet inside. Oh, so this is a different take. And he's saying that when we talk about R here, we're not talking about the parchment of upon which the psukim of the amulet were made, but rather we're talking about a piece of leather, let's call it, or whatever, a strip of hide that was used to tie around the amulet, so that the amulet would be what's the word I want to use? Would be transferred from one place to the other, and he needs a significant amount of hide to wrap the amulet inside. So apparently they knew what the size of the amulet was and what the size of the wrap that went around the amulet, and the hide that had the shear, that had enough of a size that you could wrap it around the amulet, that would be the shear from Maleches Hotzah in the case of R. So now we're up to the second question of Rava. As we said, the first question was just an introduction to the second one. Vama Abdo Bekama. Now we're talking about a different malacha in the list of 39 malachos, which is called Maleches Ma'abed, tanning. Now, if a person tans leather, how large of a piece of leather does he have to tan in order to be chayav from Maleches Ma'abed? Is it enough that he would only bother tanning a hide that had the size that you could cover the amulet? So Rav Nachman said there's no difference. Just like we said that the minimum shear in Hotzah is a size of a strip of leather that could wrap up the amulet, so too the minimum size for tanning for Maleches Ma'abed is to end up with a strip of tanned hide that could cover an amulet. Minat Tamra. I don't know exactly why Rav is asking this kind of question to his Rebbe, but he says, how do you know this? I guess when it comes to learning Torah, you're allowed to ask your Rebbe that kind of a question. You know, you must have derived it from something. And Rav Nachman indeed derives it from a Mishnah later on in Masechta Shabbos. This Nan, we have a Mishnah in Masechta Shabbos, Hamalamein, Hamenapetz, Hatzovatzovea, Vatove, Vaorek Shnei Chutim, Shiuro, Kimole, Kimlo Rochav Asit. So Malabin is someone who takes wool and he cleans the wool, he whitens the wool. And what he does is by washing it, he violates a malacha called Malabin. And then what he has to do is he's got to remove the knots in the wool. That's called menapets. He disentangles the wool. Okay?
He whitens the wool, yeah?
That was the first case. That's a malacha called malabin, and there's another malacha on the list of 39 which is called menapets, and that's a person who disentangles.
Okay.
In other words, there are all sorts of tangles, and he's got to remove them.
Right.
I think I once actually saw with my eyes, you know, raw, natural wool, and you know, you have to do a lot of malacha, so to speak, in order to improve the wool. Next we have Hatzovea. Hatzovea means dying with a Y. And then we have Hatove, to spin the threads. Shiuro, in all these cases, the minimum shear, the minimum amount that you chayev for, is Kimlo Rochav Hasit Kofel. Okay, we're talking about double the width of sit. Now, what is sit? Samach Yud Tes. Sit,
yeah,
is actually, if you take your middle finger and your index finger,
yeah,
and stretch them apart, how much of a distance is there between those two fingers? And he says that I don't know what it is, we'll call it, 2 inches, whatever you want to call it. If he whitens or disentangles or dyes or spins enough wool for a thread that's twice that length, he's chayav for all those four malachas. Again, we have four malachas here. We have malavin, we have menapets, we have tovea, and we have tove. So if he whitens or any of the others, disentangles or dyes and stuff, and he ends up with a wool that's twice the length, or the, I don't know what you call it, twice the distance between the index finger and the middle finger, twice that distance, then he's chayav. Ha'orek shnei chutim, he's chayav if he weaves just two threads. Two threads.
Are you cutting
out? No, I'm just saying this seems to be very strange. Mm-hmm. You know, until now we've been talking about some sort of a minimum size, which would be twice the length of Mole Rochav Sit. And now all of a sudden, when it comes to Oreg weaving, for some reason we don't require Mole Rochav Sit. All you require is Shnei Chutim, just two threads. I'm trying to figure out why weaving two threads is enough to be Mechayev you. And the four other malachas we said you need Kimole Rochav Sit. She, oh, one second. Maybe I stopped prematurely. Ha Oreg Shnei Chutim. Is she Uro Kimolo Rochav Hasit Hakofu? So what's happening here? He is weaving two threads, and the width of the fabric is such that a piece of thread does not cross all of the warp threads. Is once he weaves the two threads the length of a sit, he's liable. All right, so this last piece about Oreg Shnei Chutim has to be taken up in a separate discussion. Let's leave it for now, because we don't have that much time. But in any event, what does Rav Nachman derive from this brisa? Alma, he says, we see from this, actually a Mishnah, I should say, is Kevan de Litviya Koi. What do you do with raw wool? You want to spin it and create threads, right? Woolen threads. Is therefore Shi'ura Bitavui. So let's say, for example, we have the case of Malabi. And we want to know how much of a piece, how large of a piece does he have to whiten in order to be chay from Malabi. And we say that she uro betavui. And tavui means it's already spinning. Is hachinami kevan deli abdo koi she uro kima ubad. So the logic here of Rav Nachman is that the underlying principle of this Mishnah is that if you have raw wool, what do you do with raw wool? And all these different malachas that you do indicate, for example, tviya, that the measurement for malabin is going to be the amount of wool that you would take and you would spin it, or tviya, to be tova it. So the measurement for somebody who whitens, or the other malachas that we said about dyeing and disentangled, is equal to the measurement for spinning it. That's why it's all brought together in one breath in the Mishnah. And now we can apply the same logic here to Ma'abed. That's where Rav Nachman finds the source to his conclusion to answer Rav's question, that La'abdo is Bekama, and he says, Lo Shna, it's the same amount that you would need to create a covering, as we said, to wrap around the Kamiya. And the principle is the same, that just like the shear in wool is Litviya, and here too, the shear in Ibud is the shear for to be Ma'abidit, for the purpose of creating this strap. And therefore the motzi, if he takes out or, he's going to be chayav for the amount of or, the minimum amount would be to make a strap around the kamiya. And if you talk about tanning and the malach of ma'abit, it's the same amount, the shear of what it would take to create a tanned hide that could be used for covering a kamiya. So that's what we have. So Rava asks another question now. Vishaloli Abdo Bakama. What if he carries something out in Rishus Arabim and it doesn't lend itself to be tanned? No, as he takes out a hide, Amale Loshna. Meaning, even if you have hide that doesn't stand, so to speak, it's not roi to be tanned, nevertheless we apply the same shear. The measurement is the amount of hide that you would need to create a covering for an amulet. And Rava now is going to ask Kashas on Rav Nachman. Lo shani bein ma'ubad l'she'eino ma'ubad. Is there no difference between a hide that's already tan and a hide that's not tan? Esve, what are we going to do with the brisa of hamotzi samonim shruyim kidei litzbaba and dugma le'ira? The brisa says that if you take out some sort of herbs, these are samonim, and shruyim means that they were soaked, so they're used for dyeing, is how much are you chayav for being motzi these samamonim, for carrying them? And the answer is kedei litzbor ben dugma le'ira, to dye a sample that size. So you have a sample, and it's le'ira. Le'ira is somehow for a weaver. So it means the dyers would dye small pieces of cloth with different colors, and then they would show them to various prospective buyers. The size of each of this cloth was the same as that of a cloth that was used by a weaver to close the opening of a certain kli, which held the thread together. So there was a cloth that was kept wound. It's called a weft thread, and it was wound, and it had to be prevented from being unraveled to ensure that the weft thread was paid out smoothly. And Rashi has a whole long discussion about this. So the diuk now of Rava is the following: Ve'ilu b'samonim she'enam shruyim tnan. So when we have samonim that are shruyim, then we have this shear. But as far as samonim that aren't shruyim, herbs that have not yet been soaked, then we have a different Mishnah. And the Mishnah later on says, klipe agozim uklipe rimonim satin upua. So we have someone who carries nut husks or pomegranate peels or safflower or madder, and the shear that he's chayav for is enough kidei litzbor ben beged katan lefi svacha, to dye a small cloth that was put on the top of a woman's hat. That's a larger amount that you need to dye a sample swatch that we spoke about before. So we see that an unprocessed item would not be treated in the same way that you treat a processed item. So why do you, Rav Nachman, equate a case of me'ubad with she'eno me'ubad when you say hainu hach? So the Gemara rejects Rav's proof by saying ha'itmar Allah. We have a Mishnah, and the interpretation of that Mishnah is offered by Amar Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Bar Avua, lefi she'en adam toreach lishro samamonim litzvor ben dugmo le'ira. It's not worth the effort for a small amount to trouble yourself to steep herbs in order to dye a small size swatch, the size that's opening a weaver's clean, this bobbin that we spoke about. In other words, unpressed herbs are not considered significant unless you have enough, a sufficient amount that you can dye a small cloth. So a person will trouble himself to tan a piece of hide once it's large enough to make an amulet or a covering to an amulet, and therefore there's no difference between tanning and untanning. And now Rav is going to ask a second kasha from Zirone Gina. But that we'll have to pick up in the next shiur, because it's late now. So let's see where we got up to. We're on Daf Ayin Tes Amud Aleph. We're about halfway through the Amud, and we're up to the second of the wide lines, Vahani Zir'uni.